Welcome to the Ferris Love Podcast, where we share spiritual and practical ideas for how to live family life with a beautiful, self-sacrificing love.
On this special broadcast of the Ferris Love Podcast, we are joined by Tim Reckert, director of the animated Christmas film, The Star. The Star brings the nativity story to life in a fresh and creative way through the eyes of the animals who played an unexpected but vital role in the first Christmas. Tim's vision and storytelling have touched audiences around the world, and today he's here to take us behind the scenes of this incredible film. Tim, thank you so much for being on our show. We're very excited to get to talk to you about your movie, The Star, as well as kind of some future projects that you're working on.
Thanks for having me on, Mary Grace. Great to be on.
So we're just going to jump right in. We would love to discuss how you, if you want to tell us a little bit about yourself and then kind of how you got involved with this project, this awesome animated film, The Star.
Great. Yeah. So I've wanted to make movies since I was a kid, probably age 11 or 12. I got interested in it and did it as a hobby. I'm the second of six kids. And so there were plenty of kids in the house to, you know, be in the movies. And growing up, most of the movies that we made were about killing each other. So it was like, you know, lots of bottles of ketchup for blood and everything. And that was what we kind of did. But when I got to college, I discovered animation sort of surprisingly. I had thought I'll go to college. I studied history and literature, and I'll just take a 4-year break from making movies. But while I was there, I discovered this little animation class. I had never really thought of doing animation, but in taking that class, I thought, my gosh, I love this. My results are good. And meanwhile, everyone else in my class seemed to be miserable doing animation because it's so slow and painstaking, and the results were not good. So I started to think, maybe this is a place where I should like drill a little deeper. So that's how I, despite never really doing animation as a kid, I got really into animation there as a college student, then went to grad school to study it. And that sort of led me into Hollywood as an animation director. And so while I was in Hollywood looking for the first directing job that I would have, I got a call through my agent for a film that Sony Animation was developing about the Nativity. And that was kind of interesting because I got into filmmaking not specifically to make faith-based projects. I'm a cradle Catholic. I was always been a faithful Catholic too. And it's always been deeply behind my desire to make movies, but I never thought that I wanted to make faith-based movies. So at first I kind of thought, man, I don't think this is the right opportunity for me. And I went into the meeting kind of expressing a point of view that like, say, you know, Sony, look, it's great that you guys want to do this. I was surprised because I did have this faith-based shingle called Affirm that did live action faith-based things like, I can't remember. There's one about a surfer whose like leg gets bitten off by a shark or something. She was Christian. I can't remember exactly what it, but anyway, they've done some like faith-based stuff in the live action space, but never had done an animated project. I thought it was kind of cool that they were doing it, but I was in that first meeting, I was like, these things tend to not be very good. I grew up on faith-based cartoons, and if I were to do this, I would not want it. I frankly wouldn't want to make a faith-based film. I would want to make a story and character-based film because I think that's what all good movies are. And I kind of had almost thought that I was politely declining the job, but I got a call back saying, hey, they want to have another conversation with you, Tim. And so slowly I was kind of building momentum towards actually directing this thing, which was a great sign that they were open to the point of view that I had that like, if I'm going to do this, it's really got to be at a high level, at a high standard. And of course, like, yeah, they're totally aligned with that too. No one wants to make a bad movie. So that was really cool. Basically I came on board at Sony with this mandate to make this as entertaining and fun as possible and not make it like a mercy viewing experience where, you know, people watch it because they feel like they should because it's about Jesus. We went in and the film is called The Star. The whole idea, and it's funny, I mean, it's crazy that this film had not been made yet, but it's in a way it's so obvious. You look at a nativity set, you got Mary, Joseph, and the baby Jesus, but you also have all of these animals. And what we realized is that no one has ever made a movie about the story from their point of view. So it was the nativity story from the point of view of the animals. That was not my pitch. That was a concept that they had at the studio actually since the late 90s. Kind of interesting that the Henson Company had developed it. If you think back to the late 90s, you might remember a film called Babe, which was like a live action talking pig, right? And so soon after that, the Henson Company started developing the Star as like, just kind of imagine that movie, Babe, but with all the nativity animals. And the movie kind of just never got made, got stuck in development and ultimately ended up on the shelf. But when we started working on the Star, it was like, let's redevelop this for animation. And so that was kind of interesting, just to kind of pick up an old script and see like, well, now here we are in 2015 working on a script that was originally written in 1997, and what kind of things do we need to change, and just adapt to make this work. And yeah, one of the things we really wanted to do was hit the comedy note really well. It's a really important piece for family entertainment, to just be offering something where the kids will be laughing, mom and dad will be laughing, and that's a challenge when it comes to, faith-based or religious sacred subject kind of thing, because you don't want to turn Mary and Joseph into a joke, but at the same time, it's got to be fun, and that's where the animal point of view becomes really handy, because you make the animals the vehicle for the comedy. And we had a little fun too with like Joseph's relationship with the donkey and making them sort of like antagonists to each other. Yeah, so the whole thing was like a really nicely put together setup to do what I really wanted to do, which was make a movie worthy of the subject matter, which is the most important thing that has ever happened in history, God becoming one of us. So it's not something you want to take lightly or make a joke out of, but I also wanted to find a way to make it like a fun, winsome family adventure that that kids would want to watch. And the amazing thing has been, in the years since that movie came out, and it's been 7 years now, I think, I hear every year from more families who watch it year after year. So it seems to just be snowballing in its popularity, and the families who love it really love it, and a lot of kids even watch it in June and July, which to me it's insane, because it's a Christmas movie. You got to save it for Christmas. But anyway, yeah, no, it's been wonderful to see.
I love that. I used to teach, and I think we did watch it towards the end of the year. As one of those, it's a great film. I am curious though, when you, so you're the director of this film, how does that look as a director of an animated film versus, I think people can imagine, oh, you direct live action, you're behind the camera, you're telling people what to do. How does that look for an animated film and what your role?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. In a lot of ways, they're pretty similar. It's just, I mean, at least directing is very similar, because you're still just sort of telling people what to do. Or my experience of directing is that I'm the filter. Like, ideas come through me, and I. So a lot of my job is not actually generating the ideas for the movie. I'm the filter through which they pass. And so some, like a storyboard artist who's drawing out a scene might have an idea, might throw it out there, and if I love it, great, that's going in the movie. And if it's not right for this scene, because the scene actually shouldn't be that funny, so this gag's a little out of place, then it won't pass through the filter, won't make it into the film. But it's sort of, I actually think of it as very similar to a conductor of an orchestra. When you go to see the orchestra, you're going to listen to music, you're going to hear sound, right? But the kind of the funny thing is that the conductor is the one who gets all the applause, and the conductor is the one who's like not supposed to be making any sounds, right? And so it's kind of interesting, similar in that way, that like you're going to an animated film to watch actors perform, to watch animated characters move, to look at beautiful lighting and scenes and settings, and the director didn't draw any of those pictures, didn't animate any of those shots, didn't do any of the vocal performances, unless they did, but it's not part of the job. And so why, so what is that role all about? And what it's about is, anytime you're working with an ensemble and you've got your violins and your basses and your brass and your percussion, this can easily lead to chaos if there isn't like sort of one person shaping it, one vision shaping it all into a singular experience for the audience. You shouldn't really experience a symphonic piece as like multiple voices kind of talking in cacophony. It's like it's a single organic thing that everyone's contributing to. And so it's the same thing here, where the director's role is like, in a live action film, it's, I'm going to cast this actor because they look right for the part. In animation, it's like I'm working with the character designer to design this character. Character design is our version of casting, right? We need this character to have the right look. And then casting the vocal artist, we need to find the right voice for the character. And then working with the animator, we're still talking about physical performance, but it's just not something that they're doing with their body. It's something they're doing with their mouse or their pen or whatever. But ultimately, what we're going for is exactly the same thing in terms of how the audience relates to it. We want to see characters that we believe are real, encountering obstacles and overcoming those challenges and seeing how that experience changes the character. And that takes good performance. It takes music. It takes settings. It takes all these story structure, all those things. The process that we go through to generate those in animation is different. But really, as a director, I'm still just trying to craft that audience experience.
Okay, that's great. Yeah, and just you have the big picture and then you basically, yeah, synthesize it out, and that's awesome. You had mentioned earlier about how this script has, or this concept has been around since 1997, which is awesome. Can you go a little bit more in depth about that process of bringing that story to life, like coming to the conclusion that you wanted to use animals, and then how did that look step by step following it? Like, you write the script, and then what follows right after writing the script? And then,
yeah, I mean, yeah, well, so okay, one piece that's like the most obvious piece of this idea is, okay, so you're not going to do the three wise men, you're going to do the three camels, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, so that each of those wise men has a camel, at least in the traditional iconography, so like that's who our protagonists are going to be. And then it comes to like all the other pieces of the story. Okay, you've got shepherds, and there's going to be a flock of sheep, so we know we're going to want to have like a sheep character in there. Mm-hmm. And then the other piece is that, you know, Mary and Joseph are going to give, Jesus is going to be born in the manger, which is the trough that the hay is in. The manger is not, a lot of people think the manger is the building, but that's the stable. Of course, the manger is the little trough, manger, right, to eat. So it's the place where the animals eat the hay from. That's where baby Jesus is laid, but that implies that they're in the space of animals. So that usually you see an ox, and maybe sometimes a horse or something. So we had a cow, a horse, and a goat who live in the stable. But then the last piece is like, who's going to tie all this together? And there's nothing in the Bible that indicates that Mary rode on a donkey, but it is just part of the traditional iconography. And there's something so beautiful about the figure of the donkey. Donkey, you know, on the negative side, we tend to think of donkeys as being stubborn, but they're also very faithful. They just do. When you think about the image of a donkey, like going around a mill, and when that's where Bo, our main character, begins, it's very humble work. But it's you know, if you don't grind the grain, no one gets the bread. It's sort of this humble, invisible work that actually really relates to a lot of us lay people who, you know, we may not do anything particularly extraordinary, but the work that we do really can give life to the world around us if we do it for the right reason, do it for love of God. Mm-hmm. So I love the figure of this donkey. And part of what's so beautiful about it is that you get to explore a relationship with Our Lady through the eyes of the donkey. Like he becomes in a special way like a servant specifically of Mary. And so, yeah, the main thread that we very quickly landed on was like, this is about, in some ways, this is about Bo the donkey falling in love with Mary, not romantically, but just falling in love with her, with the love that she offers him, and deciding the rest of my life and the dreams that I had for my life are worth giving up if it means I get to stay with her. And so that's really the thread that we're pulling through. And one of my favorite parts of the movie is right at the very end, when Bo's looking at the Holy Family. Jesus has been born, the wise men have brought their gifts, basically the story is over, and there's the Holy Family, they're Mary, Joseph, and baby Jesus, and they're snuggling and they're all happy, and Bo's looking at them like, well, I guess my work here is done. I, you know, brought them where they needed to go. And so he kind of like gazes at them for a second, and then he starts to turn away, 'cause it's like, well, I guess I'll just go somewhere else. And then Mary says, Bo, she like whispers to him, and he looks, and then she goes, come over here. She goes, come on. And then he gets to go lie his head down in her lap. And I think it's such a beautiful moment, because I really think that's how we can relate to the Holy Family too. Like, it's not like they're their little thing and they're their pod by themselves, and we get to look at them. Like, Mary invites us in, and we, you know, so when Bo lies his head down on her lap, I just imagine doing that myself, like sitting on my Heavenly Mother's lap and being with her and snuggling with the baby Jesus and all of that. So anyway, it's the whole thing, the Bo, the donkey, really is sort of the avatar for the viewer, and the way he relates to Our Lady, I think, is the way any of us could.
Yeah, I love that. Have you had any stories, or have you heard anything from families or kids, especially like how they love the characters or how they kind of relate to one character over the other or anything like that that you could
Yeah, I
share?
do. I always hear, and I always want to know, like, if I hear from a dad or a mom, like, my kids love that movie, I always want to know what's their favorite part. And for a lot of the kids, their favorite part is it's the dance that Dave the Dove does, and he's like wiggles his butt. And I apologize to parents who don't find that appropriate. I consider it borderline myself, but it is, kids love it. That's a fun moment. And then another thing people love is the camel voiced by Tracy Jordan, Tracy Morgan. Oh my gosh, he had a character on 30 Rock that had almost the same name, and I can never remember which one is 30 Rock name. Anyway, the camel that's always going Deborah, Deborah, and sometimes I get, like, parents will text me video of their kids doing imitations of him, and in particular, what was it? Look with your eyes, look with your eyes, right? So anyway, kids love that character. I love him too, and recording that voice was so much fun with Tracy, and he is a real character, and so much of that part is just ad-libbed and just him doing his thing. So yeah, and then. And what else? I've gotten some really sweet things from especially little girls who seem to have, like, identified Mary as, like, their favorite character. And so one little girl from just north of Tucson, my hometown, sent me a little I don't know what it is. It looks kind of like a clothespin that she painted to look like Mary. And that's sitting on my shelf. And I've gotten also a little card that a girl drew with a picture of Our Lady as she looks in the movie. So yeah, it's just kind of runs the gamut, but it seems like everyone kind of finds their character that they can identify with.
Yeah, that's excellent. Awesome. And yeah, you mentioned Tracy Morgan as one of those stars that you worked with. Were you involved in the process of hiring, the musicians, the actors,
Yeah,
you as a director and
for sure. Yeah, it depends on what kind of movie you do. In a studio film, I was kind of surprised, although I sh now realize I was just being naive. I thought, I'm the director, I'm the boss. And when you're directing a movie at the studio, you're directing the studio's movie. And so hopefully there's alignment there. And if there isn't, you will quickly see yourself out this is when you hear about creative differences. It's like, yeah, because you don't just get to make your movie at the studio. So there's, like, this process of negotiation with the studio, and you have to try to convince the executives of your vision. And sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. To talking about, like, the building of the team and the hiring of the cast, the advantage to that is that then you have the studio doing the casting with you, and Oprah does a voice in this movie, and that was just a quick text message from our executive producer Devon Franklin, who just, he knows Oprah, and he knows Tyler Perry, and it was the same thing. It was like, hey, do you guys want to be in the movie? And so that was a very sort of easy process, and all of it seemed, it's at least, like, can we get them? Yes, I'd love to have them. And the nice thing too is that it's not that much about, like, values alignment, because what we're looking for in those parts is comedy. And so whether someone's a Christian or not for a role like that doesn't necessarily matter that much, although it can add resonance. And a lot of these actors did come on board the film. Like, for instance, Ving Rhames, who's the voice of one of the dogs, the big scary dog. And Ving is known for being, like, scary gangsters, like in Pulp Fiction, and he's also in Mission Impossible. Like, he's a good guy there, but he's just, like, a tough guy, right? As a result, there aren't a lot of movies that he can share with his kids. And so this is, like, I'm excited that I can actually do a movie that my kids can watch. But then, when it came to casting Mary and Joseph, that was maybe the I don't want to say the trickiest, because it's not like it was hard to come to the decision that we did, but I just felt like this is the one that matters the most. And if we get this wrong, we could really screw up our movie. So Zachary Levi voices Joseph, and yeah, people know him and love him from Tangled, and he's great in Tangled. And it was, kind of the whole idea here was we wanted someone who felt manly and virtuous, but also was just great with comedy. And he did a great, you know, I remember at one point we were doing, the way you record voices for an animated film is you'll do one line at a time and you'll try it different ways. So we were doing a scene, there's a scene about two thirds of the way through the movie when Mary and Joseph hit their low point on the journey, their cart breaks down, nothing's going right, and they are getting really frustrated. And they basically, Joseph is like, this is not going well, Mary. And Mary's whole arc in the movie is realizing that just because God has a plan doesn't mean this is going to be easy. And we can talk more about like developing an arc for a lady, because I think that was a really interesting challenge here. But in any case, they kind of have an argument here. It's not an argument because someone's at fault. It's just because like they are stuck and they don't know what the way forward should be. We were running some line, I don't remember which one, with Zachary on Joseph. And I was like, great, can we try one? This just got like a little more edge of anger. And Zachary like kind of didn't do anything for a sec. And I was like, Zach, is, you know, any questions? He's like, ah, man, I don't think I want to go there with him. I don't think it feels right for him. And, you know, at some level it's like, I'm the director, you do what I say, you know, but I was really glad actually that Zach had such a strong feel for his character and was like taking ownership of it, of that character of Joseph. So I feel very grateful actually in retrospect for that moment when he pushed back, because I think he took the role seriously and wanted to deliver a Joseph that he knew and could understand. And so anyway, so we cast him very well. Mary was Gina Rodriguez, who at the time was really known for Jane the Virgin, which was kind of a funny sort of like accidental intersection. But the reason we loved Gina for the role was that she was youthful, just had a youthful, likable voice that felt like, you know, she had a nice laugh that makes you want to laugh with her. And the whole idea was, especially as a Catholic making a film about the nativity, and there have been plenty of films about the nativity, and some of them you always want to make Mary relatable. Some of them make Mary relatable by leaning into like bad teenage behavior that from a Catholic standpoint just doesn't make sense for how we understand Our Lady, because we believe that Our Lady was spared from original sin and therefore like fully executed on God's will in her life. So this is not a character that you can cheat by making relatable just by showing her sinning. Essentially, it's like she's relatable because of her flaws. Maybe for most character that works, most characters that might work, but for Mary that really is not the way that a Catholic can go. And so the challenge there was, how do we make her truly holy, like the God's only perfect human creature, without making her feel like, I don't want to hang out with her, she's like too perfect, she's too holy. And that it's really, if that's kind of where you're starting, that's a sign of a limited imagination and actually sort of a broken idea of what holiness is. Because when you actually look at the saints, what you find is that the more holy someone gets, the more people want to hang out with them and the more lovable and likable they become. So with Mary, then we need to find a way to really embody that with this character and make her someone that you want to spend time with, that you want to snuggle up with, that, you know, you want her to laugh at your jokes, you want her to tease you, all those things. And so, anyway, Gina was, you know, was great for that role and for that take on her. And maybe it's a good time for me to talk about the thing I was mentioning, which was like the character arc for Our Lady, because a lot of times with a character arc, the character is starting in a place of a flaw and they have to go and overcome their dramatic flaw to the end and realize like, hey, I was kind of selfish at the beginning and I'm going to, you know, I realize I need to live life for others or whatever it was. I was fearful here and now I need to be less. But the trick is like, if Mary is sinless, then where are you going to find that arc? And if she doesn't have an arc, then as a character, she's flat. She's never changing. That can work. I mean, Forrest Gump doesn't really arc. Marty McFly doesn't really arc. Like these, there are characters who just kind of do their thing and the world changes around them. Ferris Bueller is another example. But I wanted to embrace the challenge of like, is there an arc here that's scripturally justified and that works with the Catholic understanding of Mary as you know, fully aligned with God's will? And what I looked at, just looking at the scriptures, I realized there is actually a lot of material here to work with it. And just for example, when the angel appears to Mary and says, hey, God wants you to give birth to his son. A lot of times when angels appear to people in the Bible, it says, do not be afraid. And Mary gets the, do not be afraid, Mary, for you have found favor with God. I guess you contrast Mary's reaction to like Zechariah's reaction, and there's a real just like, cool, okay, let's do it, you know? And yeah, she asks a follow-up question, but the follow-up question is not like, are there any guarantees? What's this gonna be like? Can you tell me what to expect? It's just like, I think there might be a problem because I am a virgin. All to say, there seems to be evidence there, if you read between the lines, that Mary has this character of just saying yes. Like, I'm gonna say yes, and God's gonna take care of it. And maybe she's the type of personality, now kind of, again, just building upon on that foundation, maybe she's the type of person who's like happy with improvising, happy without a plan. Let's just go out there and see what happens, which was great, because then you look at Joseph, he's a carpenter, and maybe today he'd be like a mechanical engineer or something like that. And you can see like, okay, there's justification for him having the opposite kind of personality. Like, I'm a planner. I need to, you know, I need all my tools organized by size and all that, you know. So that's his personality type. And now you have the material for like a really interesting relationship where there's complementary opposites at work, which leads to conflict, again, not because someone's bad and someone's good, but just because like we see the world a different way. And Mary's like, hey, don't worry about it, we're gonna be fine. And Joseph's like, yeah, but like, how, you know, can we write this down, make a to-do list? The great thing for Joseph is, of course, like they arrived to Bethlehem and they can't even find a hotel room. Like, any plan that Joseph had falls apart and is a complete disaster. So what Joseph has to learn along this journey is to let God take the wheel sometimes and just trust, and not always have to be in control at all times. With Mary, the arc is, I think, again, scripturally justified, because I'm sort of borrowing for something that comes after the nativity. But if you recall, then later in the, when they go to Jerusalem to present Jesus at the presentation, right, they meet Simeon and Anna, and Simeon says, your own heart a sword shall pierce, inspired by the Holy Spirit. So there's this moment of prophecy where Mary's given a message. And I guess I feel like you don't, you know, if you tell someone like you've got mustard on your shirt, you assume that they don't know. That's why you would bother telling them, right? So, so here, I guess it's like, I think the Holy Spirit is using Simeon to tell Mary, your own heart a sword shall pierce, because at some level, maybe Mary needs to hear that. Because maybe she doesn't know that yet. Maybe it hasn't sunk in for her what this means yet. And this is a warning that God wants to give to her, because she needs it. And so that's the arc that I thought we could do, even though we don't meet Simeon and Anna in the movie. It's kind of interesting to start Mary in this place of like, great, the Messiah is coming. Like, this is all good. It's all good news. Everything's going to be happy and wonderful because God loves us. And then realizing along the way, and she has this line in the movie, just because God has a plan doesn't mean it's going to be easy. Actually, kind of an interesting Easter egg. That moment happens, this is in that low point scene I've been talking about. On the road to Bethlehem, Mary and Joseph, like the cart breaks, everything's going wrong. Joseph's freaking out because it's like, Lord, I don't know how to do this. Like, you know, and Mary goes off by herself to go presumably talk to God and just kind of be alone for a second and just like gather herself. And in the early drafts of this movie, what she went off. And what you see in the movie is she goes off and Joseph finds her sitting on a rock, like looking out at the landscape. And that's about it. But what she was originally doing there was that she had wandered off, and on the route to Bethlehem, you're going to pass by Jerusalem. And the flight of fancy that we took was maybe you walk past Golgotha. And so in that moment, like it may be in my ideal version of the movie, or at least parents can imagine this, what Mary discovers as she goes wandering off alone by herself is on a distant hilltop, three crosses standing there in the mist and having this intuition of like, that's where this road is leading. Mm-hmm. So what Mary is confronting there when she goes off by herself is like, this is headed for some real pain and tragedy, actually. And that's what is scaring her in this moment. And Joseph then is able to reassure her like, yeah, we don't know what's coming. You know, this is very scary, but I'm here for you. I'll be here for you. And we'll do this together, you know? Mm-hmm. But yeah, kind of an interesting thing. We had the three crosses there at one point in a test screening, but the audience did not get what I was going for. They felt like, oh, that's for Easter. That's not for Christmas. And it's like, yeah, I mean, I get it. The cross is not like usually part of the iconography of Christmas, but, and by the way, it works perfectly fine without it. But I do think if especially if parents want to have that thing in the back of their mind next time they watch it, I think it might add a layer of meaning to what I'm trying to do there with Our Lady's character arc.
Yeah. Well, and that's exactly like the what everything you just explained is perfect for why this movie is so great for not only just children but for adults too, because it is very thought-provoking and just yeah, it has the comedy aspect, but then also there's a lot of just things that you consider that, you know, yeah, just to allow yourself to imagine in a sense of how things work. And I love that with the animals too, and you know, them having voices and their own characters, kids can also put themselves into, oh, I would love to be imagine myself being the donkey in the midst of this beautiful scene of the nativity.
Totally. And it reminds me of Saint Jose Maria's thing. I think he said like another character on the scene. He said, just imagine yourself in the Gospels, like another character in the scene. And that's totally what this whole experience making this movie was like, okay, if you're the donkey, what are you thinking? If you're this, what are you thinking? And you read Saint Jose Maria's book, Holy Rosary, especially in the Joyful Mysteries, and he talks about like being the little servant who's helping Mary when she receives the message from Angel Gabriel in the Annunciation. But equally, and I'm sure he would agree too, like you could also be the little mouse that's there in our movie, who's just standing in the corner trying to steal some crumbs and watching like, what the heck is this? You know, so it's very in line with the way Saint Jose Maria approached the Gospels.
Yeah, that's awesome. You had mentioned you had a couple of Easter eggs that, you know, you were there any other ones that parents or kids can kind of keep an eye on that, or even
Yeah,
just some fun stories that you have to share about just the
sure.
process of it all?
Okay, well, Easter egg wise, there is a funny, you know, one way I started to think about this movie was like, this is like a comic book movie where we need to be introducing this superhero to people who have never picked up a comic book, and we need to be giving enough like little goodies to the people who love the comic books and reward them for their, you know, loving readership, right? So, okay, so an example of doing that for this movie was one of my favorite lines is kind of thrown away. I don't know how many people notice it, but when Zechariah and Elizabeth are hanging out at Mary's at Joseph's house for the wedding, we just for fun thought like, what if Zechariah is a real loudmouth and just like won't shut up? And then at some point, they're walking out and he's stuck his foot in his mouth for the third time, and Elizabeth is like, you know, I think I liked you better when you couldn't talk. Which I think is such a funny line, and I do imagine like, you know, they're like this older couple, like what would they have been like, and what's the fun version of them? And I think there's something fun in like imagining them as being a little bit at odds, and maybe Elizabeth was like, "What, you're telling me like you can't talk, not even a little bit?" Yeah, you know, like
That's
potentially.
great.
So there was that, yeah, and yeah, I wonder what else. No, there were funny moments. There was a moment along the road, just you know, working on a film with some key people who were Christian and knew the story very well and were believers, but a lot of the people at the studio weren't, and they nevertheless pursuing this movie in good faith because you know they want to give the audience something because this is show business. Because if we give that audience something that really pleases them, then we stand to make money, and that's why this studio is here. So, but there were some fun, sort of funny moments where it was just like I'll just tell you this. The story I'm thinking about is at one point we got a note from an executive saying, "Man, I think Act Three just feels a little slow. Is it? Can we amp it up? Like, could King Herod kidnap Mary or something?" And we were like, "No, sorry, I don't think we can do that." So,
Oh, no joke.
yeah.
Oh, wow. Wow. That's kind of funny how you'd think people would know the story, but I guess
Right. Well, the question of like how far can we tweak this, you know, is like, well,
not.
that one's definitely over the line. I don't know what the line is, but that one's over it, you know.
Exactly. Okay. Last question just about this experience of making this film. Did you have, were there any moments where you were just very, you know, impressed or just kind of inspired or, you know, profoundly affected by, you know, the process of creating this film or even seeing the film finally, like when it was completed, that just resonates or remains with you now, even to this day?
Yeah, you know, okay, I guess maybe there's a couple of answers that come to mind. Part of what I would say is that the moment that I already talked about, where Bo looks back at the Holy Family and thinks, well, okay, my job here is done. Every time I think about that, I get a little knot in my throat. And so I already talked about that and how beautiful I find that, because I really think that's the truth of how we stand in relationship to the Holy Family, that we're being invited in, even though we don't belong anywhere near there. And that's very moving to me. That part of the movies has always been my favorite. And in particular, my favorite shot in the entire movie is in that spot. And it's so funny. Like I've watched this movie a lot of times, and anyone who's a filmmaker or any sort of artist, I'm sure, would recognize the experience of, like, when you watch your own stuff, the only thing you notice are those things that got screwed up. And so, like, there's plenty of things in that movie where I'm like, oh, you know, and just like can't bear to watch it. But then after this movie, where like some shots are over animated and there's too much going on and, you know, whatever, there is this shot where Bo gazes at them, and they're, and I remember directing the animator on that shot, this guy named Joe. He did three passes at that shot before I approved the animation. And it was so interesting because, like, we kept wanting to like have Bo do something, but it was just stripping it down. And so what it is just like, it's just this, a shot of finally nothing happening, of just Bo looking. And there's just this nice silence and openness to it that, I think I've grown as a filmmaker, having realized, like, the most beautiful shot in this movie to me is the one where almost nothing is happening. And I think now I kind of realize how important it is to give the audience some repose and give the audience room to just live in a moment. So anyway, that, not only is that my favorite story moment in the movie, but it's also my favorite aesthetic experience of the movie, is the, when finally everything slows down and you just sit there with it, you know.
Wow. Yeah. Excellent. Well, if our audience has, you know, listened to this podcast and would love to watch the movie, The Star is, I'm sure, on all kinds of platforms.
Yeah, Sony doesn't have its own streamer, so it never has like a particular home. It's been on Netflix, then it's been on Pureflix, and it's been on this and that. I think the best way to find it probably is to get a Blu-ray on Amazon, or find a digital rental on Amazon, or a digital copy, I guess. I still buy DVDs because I like having a shelf of movies.
And we'd love to hear about kind of some things that you're working on now. So you worked on that movie 7 years ago.
Right.
What have been some other things that you've been working on in your
project? Yeah, so the big thing that I'm really excited about has been the work of the past couple of years, and it's starting a new studio called Sycamore Studios. So I'm the co-founder of a studio called Sycamore Studios. We are dedicated to doing good, true, and beautiful family entertainment. And, you know, I say that it kind of going full circle to where I started, saying that we aren't specifically doing faith-based content at all, although of course I am a Catholic filmmaker, but my belief is that we can really offer families of faith and families who aren't of faith a lot of real solid value and truth, beauty, and goodness with movies that aren't necessarily on sacred subjects. And so what we want to provide is entertaining movies that are really rooted in these values, timeless values, and I know that there are a lot of families who are looking for an alternative because they're not happy with what's being offered to them. They don't feel that it's trustworthy, and they don't, whether it's trustworthy or not, a lot of parents just think, man, the stuff that is coming out today is just not built to last. Like, I see it once and I don't really want to see it again. And I think if you really are putting real value into movies, then they do become rewatchable. And the proof of that is the movies that I love to show my kids are the movies that I grew up with myself, you know, because I think those were really great films. Sycamore Studios, it's our new initiative. We've announced our first film, which is a Dr. Dolittle, first animated Dr. Dolittle feature film. Should be coming in the next few years. And we've got two more films that we'll be announcing very soon based on best-selling graphic novels series. If anyone wants to follow us and kind of get more news, we are on social media, not doing much there, but what I recommend is go to sycamorestudios.com, and we've got a sign-up list for people to kind of put in their emails. It lands on a database, and when we have announcements, we'll be putting them out through any of those email addresses that come to us on the website. So yeah, sycamorestudios.com is a place to sign up for more news, and we're really excited to just be bringing movies that are made to be classics back to the theaters for families.
Yeah, I love that. Wow, thank you. And we'll include that definitely in the show notes. And so thank you, Tim, so much for sharing your experience with this movie and directing. And also, we hope for a lot of success for this future project of yours too.
Thanks so much, Mary Grace.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Ferris Love Podcast. In 2024, we want to reach as many people as possible. You can help by sharing this episode with a friend, subscribing to the podcast, or leaving a review. To learn more, visit us at ferrislovshrine.org.